Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network in Environmental Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm Matt Brown, the host of the channel. I'm currently an MA candidate at the University of Wyoming studying cultural history, focusing on environment and science. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Andrea Duffy about her new book, No Man's Land, Pastoralism and French Environmental Policy in the 19th Century Mediterranean World, published by University of Nebraska Press in 2019. Dr. Andrea Duffy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on as well. And before we really dive into your wonderful book, I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. Happy to, Matt. Thank you. So I'm a world environmental historian, and I currently direct the international studies major at Colorado State University. So that's an interesting combination for me. And it's a little bit of a circuitous path that I took to get here. As a world environmental historian, I study primarily patterns and relationships across cultures. So this book, for example, looks at common themes around the Mediterranean, including really three case studies in the Middle East, North Africa, and Southern France. So very much cross-cultural, but I'm really fascinated by the kinds of patterns that emerge, especially when you look from an environmental perspective. Since I've been at CSU directing international studies, I think my work and my research interests have taken an even broader turn. I am particularly interested in incorporating sources and methods from other disciplines like geography and the natural sciences. My current pet interest is climate history, and you see a little bit of that in this book, but I think even more since then. And I also am particularly concerned about the contemporary implications of history. And I think that's the international studies influence as well. Before taking a foray into international studies, I was primarily focused on the past. And now I still think about the past, but I'm really interested in how the past impacts the present and lessons we can learn from it.
That's a wonderful intro to both your background and the book. Now, would you just like to just give a brief introduction about nomadic lands, or sorry, no man's land?
Sure. So No Man's Land is a Mediterranean history, or that's what I'm calling it. And what I mean by that, because it's sort of Mediterranean is sort of a contested term or contested construct. What I mean by it is that one of the things I'm hoping to do with this book is connect parts of the Mediterranean and just regions in general that scholars typically don't connect, in particular, Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. So I think it makes sense because they shared common environmental features as well as cultural patterns and political connections as well. And this book highlights a lot of those. So it's really a Mediterranean story, and it tells that story through three case studies, one in Provence in the south of France. So that's sort of the northern case study, one in southwestern Anatolia, which is modern day Turkey. So that's the eastern end of the Mediterranean, and one in Algeria, which was a French colony during the 19th century. So that's the South Pole or the South End. And by using these three case studies, it really tries to access developments all around the Mediterranean. But it shows how those developments were connected in a way that I think justifies the use of the Mediterranean as a concept. So that's part of it. And then it's very much an environmental history. It's framed through relations between environments and human societies. And I think environmental history particularly makes sense to consider across borders. You know, environmental features don't stop at political borders. And the kinds of developments that my book engages in particular definitely cross borders. And then even the characters themselves, some of the key players in my story are French foresters and nomads or shepherds. And they absolutely cross borders as well in multiple ways and had very close relationship with the environment. So it's very much an environmental history. And then finally, I think I like to think anyway, maybe because I enjoy these kinds of stories, it's a little bit of a mystery. It's trying to solve a mystery. So it's a little bit of a detective story. And that central question, that mystery is really, what happened to all the sheep? So if you go to the Mediterranean, really anywhere around the Mediterranean today, this is a little less true in the south and east, but it's likely that you won't see any sheep or goats. You may, but they're certainly not everywhere. But if you read literature that refers to periods before the 19th century, sheep were everywhere. This was the land of sheep. So my study is really an investigation of what happened to all the sheep. Where did they go? Why did they disappear? And the answer, it turns out, has a lot to do with politics. So I don't know if you want me to summarize the book or go into another question.
You know, I think we could go into another question. That was a good summary, or that was like a good introduction to the topic itself. But getting into the organization of the book, one, it's really it's fantastic. Like I was immersed just because of the way that you were able to craft your narrative. So definitely kudos on that. But let's just begin with like chapter one. It's titled "The Land of the Golden Fleece." And it seemed to be a deeper history leading into the 19th century, which is your focus. And it really, you can really see that it is a land of sheep. So, would you like to talk about just kind of these foundational, cultural/environmental origins of this story?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. That first chapter tries to set the stage or establish a foundation before the 19th century, because the 19th century is when everything changed in all three case studies. And it does that also by reinforcing this environmental framework and telling the story of the land. So describing the land, highlighting connections or similarities, ecological similarities in the three case studies and the three contexts around the Mediterranean, but also pointing out important differences. So I don't want to give the impression that the Mediterranean environment is uniform. It's not. Rainfall patterns and rainfall variability were quite different in Algeria than they were in Provence and also in Anatolia. So there are important differences as well. And that first chapter emphasizes those differences. Another thing that it tries to do is give some more some deeper social and political history, and again, emphasize connections across the three case studies and around the Mediterranean in general, as well as some important distinctions. And in the process, I think it contests some commonly held perceptions. So for example, in Eastern Anatolia, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in Anatolia, during that period, it was under the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire made a lot of concessions to nomads. So there's sort of a common perception that that nomads were antithetical to the state, and that the state was always trying to get rid of them or trying to get them to settle. But when you take a closer look, it turns out that the state, well, first of all, didn't have the power prior to the 19th century to get these nomadic populations to settle and to stay settled. And then it also saw the advantage of leveraging nomadic groups and the leaders of nomadic groups as a sort of provincial authority. So that was more of a pattern than there were sedentarization campaigns in the early modern period in Ottoman Anatolia. But in the cases that they existed, it was usually just sort of a game where they were like, okay, now you need to settle and become farmers. And the nomads would be like, okay, but next year we're going to run away and become nomads again. And then the pattern would repeat itself. And the reason that the government, I should be clear, the reason the government had an interest in settling them at all was because it made them easier to count for census purposes, to tax. And also nomads had a little bit of a pesky habit of preying on villagers, which could be seen as a symbiotic relationship because they also provided valuable services to farmers and villagers, but they could be troublesome at times as well. So that's the pattern in the Ottoman realm, and also to a large degree in Anatolia, because that was part of the Ottoman Empire as well, although provincial, so it was a little bit different, and there was more local authority. It's interesting how similar it actually is in France, and this is one of my main points, that France and European history are often considered to be very different than Ottoman history and Middle Eastern history, to the point where even the people, the shepherds involved, are called different things. In the Ottoman case, they're called nomads or semi-nomads, there are a few other terms, but they're fairly specific to that region, whereas shepherds in the south of France are called shepherds. Sometimes they're called transhuman shepherds, but they're never called nomads. However, they had very similar patterns, and this is another thing I talk about in that first chapter. I point out that whereas there's this perception, again, kind of a misconception, that French shepherds were, you know, that there's this image of the lonely shepherd. There's this idea that they would travel by themselves, and you kind of see these bucolic images of the shepherd, you know, with all the sheep gathered around him. In fact, they usually traveled in groups with other shepherds. So many, many different people were involved in especially larger herds or a combination of herds. And they often took their families with them and lived in fairly simple accommodations in the mountains in the summertime, but, you know, still like cabins and things. So they had an established home in the mountains as well as an established home on the plain. So they're seasonal, and they also traveled long distances, sometimes upwards of 500 miles. So their seasonal commute was very similar around the Mediterranean, and even the social practices were more similar than people often like to think. So I think all of those things together help sort of establish a foundation for the rest of the story. They by providing an image of what life was like around the Mediterranean and how critical pastoralism was to that life, which sets up the story for what changed and how dramatically it changed in the 19th century.
Yes, and that speaks back to that mystery you're talking about. But before we get there, do you want to talk about the Algerian experience just to round out all of the Mediterranean poles?
Oh, yeah, sure. Like I said, Algeria was part of the Ottoman Empire until 1830, when it was occupied by France, invaded by France, and then the French occupation, French colonization of Algeria was a long and very painful period that ended with a long and very painful war in the 1960s. So, which is after the period that I look at, but even in the 19th century, I think a misconception there that that I'm certainly not the first person to point out, but it persists nonetheless, is that France went in, pacified the country, and it was a French colony. This is a misconception, or this misconception exists partly because France wanted to pretend it was that way, but the reality is it took 50 years or more for France to gain anything approaching control of Algeria. And even in the late 19th century, there were still significant regions that were outside of French control. But an important part of my story, and this is getting ahead of myself a little bit, but I think it's important, it relates to that foundational aspect as well. A very central component of France's effort to pacify and control Algeria was forestry. It used environmental policy to try and gain control over the country and the countryside. But similar to Anatolia and Provence, before the arrival of French imperial agents, Algeria was largely inhabited by nomadic pastoralists, especially in the countryside. There was certainly a significant population of farmers as well, and there were some urban centers such as Algiers. But again, pastoralists had played an important role and a largely symbiotic role with farmers and other members of the population before French colonists arrived.
Thank you for that. And that really sets us up for what happened in the 19th century, which is kind of what your second chapter, Black Sheep, the intellectual roots of Mediterranean environmental policy, gets at. What happened in the 19th century, especially with your case study of forestry, that really illustrates environmental, the relation of humans to the environment?
Yeah, so I think I'll answer this question by kind of drawing from the second and the third chapter. So the second chapter attempts to, and as a little bit of an aside, this was a really difficult book to organize. So I appreciated your comment at the beginning that you think I did a good job of organizing it. It's really, a comparative study, a multicultural study. A broad study like this is—it's really difficult to organize, and I thought about it a lot. So that first chapter kind of lays an environmental foundation. The second chapter lays what I'd like to think of as an intellectual foundation, and then the third chapter builds on both of them. So the third chapter looks specifically at the development of French scientific forestry, but that intellectual development relates very much to these perceptions that I talk about in chapter two, Black Sheep. So a little bit more about those perceptions. So in French modern society, especially as scientific forestry began to develop, and it was influenced largely by Prussian forestry or German forestry in the late 18th, early 19th century, there was this perception that sheep were bad, that they were really, they had a majorly negative impact on the environment. So specifically, there was this concern that if sheep were anywhere near a forest, especially near young trees, so saplings, that they would just eat the tree and the trees would not grow. This isn't true. But the reason people thought it was true was because they looked at the Mediterranean. And the Mediterranean looks very different than the forests of Northern Europe. So even forests in the Mediterranean Forests in the Mediterranean tend to be really open. The trees are sort of more scraggly. They're really more like large bushes versus the forests of Northern Europe. So where modern European forestry was developed in Prussia, now Northern Germany, as well as the French forestry school in Nancy, which is also in northeastern France, the forests were these high growth, lush, thick, you know, dark green spaces. And so when they compared that environment to the Mediterranean, and also when they read accounts from history, including like antiquity, which they were particularly interested in during the Enlightenment and the, you know, scientific developments while French forestry was developing, or scientific literature while French forestry was developing, they asked themselves, well, what happened? You know, why does it look so different? Because, you know, Romans would describe the Mediterranean region as being lush and like a green area, site for growth, and abundant trees and harvests and that kind of thing. Mostly because they had a very different perspective coming from Italy and the Mediterranean themselves than the French did. But the French didn't necessarily think about that. And this part of the argument draws a lot on Diana Davis's Resurrecting the Granary of Rome. So there's a lot of great stuff there. But as a result of these perceptions or really environmental misconceptions, the sheep and consequently the shepherds got a lot of negative press by French scientists and intellectuals and political officials in the early 19th century. And as a result, when France produced its first modern forestry code in 1827, there is a lot in there about sheep and goats and preventing them from going anywhere near forests. So the question then is, well, what does this have to do with Mediterranean and nomads? It's a problem, not because the sheep were grazing in forests in their summer and winter pastures. Pastures are different than forests. But the concern was that because they were transhuman, because they were mobile, because they moved seasonally between summer and winter pastures, the concern was that they would pass through forests and they would destroy the trees along the way. And so as a result, the French Forest Administration went to great lengths to try not just keep sheep out of forests of any kind, but also to keep sheep and shepherds from migrating seasonally. So to end mobile pastoralism, to end transhuman practices, because they were concerned about their environmental impact. And then I can also add another layer on that. The result, this is again getting ahead of myself a little bit, it wasn't necessarily beneficial for the environment because other things stepped in, like industry and commercial agriculture. But I think the foresters involved, so the people who crafted the French Forest Code of 1827, and the forest agents who worked in Provence, and then some of those same agents actually traveled to the Ottoman Empire to develop scientific forestry in the Ottoman Empire, as well as in Algeria. And the same forest code that was applied in France was applied to Algeria, even though it was a very different environment in the mid 19th century. So I think those forest agents, even though they were in some ways misguided, they meant well. They really, really thought, they really believed that mobile pastoralism had a negative environmental impact. And they really wanted to kind of save the planet. In some ways they were misguided, but idealistic sort of proto-environmentalists. And if there are villains in the story, it is then the politicians, the policymakers who took the arguments of those French foresters, the French forest agents, and use them for their own political means. So French policymakers, as well as Ottoman administrators, they had their own reasons for wanting to end mobile pastoralism, get the nomads to settle, get the shepherds to settle. And primarily they were about making it easier to count them and to tax them. They had their own reasons, but they used these environmental arguments as justification in Provence, Algeria, and Ottoman Anatolia.
Yeah, and you get into that, especially in the later part of the book, where the nomads or the transhuman shepherds become these scapegoats, correct?
Yes, exactly. And especially, I guess I said I was going to cover chapters 2 and 3, but really when I'm talking about the application of French forestry in the Ottoman Empire and Algeria, that's particularly detailed in chapter 4, The Forest for the Trees, and how these ideals that were specific to France and really, I mean, they were promulgated in northern France, not the Mediterranean, but they were based on that environmental difference and a perceptions about it. And then they were applied kind of wholesale around the Mediterranean to, you know, not so great results for societies and the environment.
Yeah. And one thing I really appreciate, Aidan, and I think it really solidified by the end, but I was picking it up all the way through, was your presentation of how these forests are starting to, they're recognizing that there's something wrong with the forest, especially I think it starts in France and then it moves to Algeria, and then the Ottoman Empire is kind of, they're later in the game. But like one quote that you have in, I think this is the second chapter, you talk about the violent winds in Provence and each spring and fall, and they were recast as the child of men and a result of these forest clearings and tree cuttings, and then like really like goats and sheep, as you said. And one thing I really realized was the visibility of trees is a driving force to that. Is that something that you recognize in terms of recognizing kind of greater climatic like destructions or changes, like what being able to see something like a tree or a forest like dissolve, or at least the perception of it dissolving, like is that a big driver for these proto-environmentalists?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it, you know, it even is for that misconception about the Mediterranean. You know, a lot of these foresters, not all of them, some of them are from southern France, but a lot of them came from northern France. And had certain ideas about how the environment was supposed to look and how it was supposed to feel too. So wind is a feeling, and if you've ever felt the Mistral, it's not just wind. It's like the description of it, the sort of the personification of it is totally understandable. It's violent, and there's a similarly violent wind in Algeria. And so in some ways these were foreign environmental features, even for French foresters. And in a way, and I talk about this in a book, the attempt to control environments and people in Provence, even in Provence, was similar to internal colonization, because it was still, in many cases, or an example of people coming from outside and telling local populations what they could and couldn't do and what was best for them. And they were guided by these, as much as anything, these images and these experiences of nature that were foreign to them and that they kind of feared. Another important element, I think, that relates to what you're getting at or what you're suggesting with imagery is fire. Fire was something that was always, it was a constant part of the Mediterranean world. And for inhabitants of the Mediterranean world, it wasn't necessarily a scary thing. It could be, certainly, but it was also a tool. So pastoralists, for example, used fire to regenerate, to create and regenerate pasture. That was another thing that French foresters very much cracked down upon everywhere they could. And in every instance, they hated it. They hated fire. They thought that fire, forest fire, wildfires were just in every case bad. And that's another interesting misconception that's taken a long time for modern scientific forestry to kind of reconcile or readdress. Only recently has fire and controlled burns and that kind of thing have these things really been recognized by the Forest Service, including the American Forest Service, but also in European contexts and around the world as being something useful and something good and even something necessary to prevent larger conflagrations. But in the 19th century, fire was seen as fundamentally bad, as scary, as sort of evil. Same with the wind. And these are all, and then there were other disasters. So landslides, floods. These are just a few of the things that were blamed on mobile pastoralists in all of the contexts, all of the Mediterranean contexts that I talk about.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and I, when you were talking about sheep earlier, I totally wrote sheep and fire as these two negative elements that are associated with shepherds or nomads. And this kind of also gets into the colonial or imperial discussion that you have throughout, where you have these different levels. You have the foresters on the ground, but then you have, they're also dealing with people back in the metropole who have their own set of interests that seem to be more based off of control and domination over the landscape, so they can actually colonize and improve or create civilization. And I think that speaks to chapters 3 and 4 and then throughout. But is that something you want to talk about? Maybe these diverging and diverging and converging interests of these different parties?
Yeah, I mean, another thing I'm trying to do with this book is tease out the different players and their interests. I think there's too often a dichotomy between colonizers and colonized, and as well as I would say between colony and metropole. I think there are important nuances and layers that kind of get lost in those dichotomies. And you know, an example of them is these foresters who were imperial agents, but they were really trying to be advocates for the environment. I mean, if there is a selfish interest, that was primarily it in many cases. There are also colonial players who were in many ways advocates for local populations in Algeria, for example. So the Arab bureaus served as offices. They were largely military organizations or run through the military, and they were often in regions that were less well controlled and that had a larger indigenous population. So rural areas in particular, rather than cities, which is where most of the French and European colonists settled. And the Arrow bureaus weren't always successful in advocating for indigenous inhabitants and you know, nomads and other Algerians, but they did try. They were more likely to speak Arabic. And in a lot of the sources that I read, their correspondence with the French Algerian governor and the central administration back in Paris, they're really trying to tell the French government to back off. You know, they're like, you know, for your own good, you're squeezing this population too much, and they are going to fight back. And they actually did. There was a major revolt in Algeria that was then put down within a year and resulted in an even worse situation for the colonized. But that's another example of sort of these nuances or these different players who I think are a little bit misrepresented just as the colonizers or colonial agents. And another example of that is in talking about forest agents in Algeria, there were indigenous Algerian forest agents, particularly in regions where the French had less control. They required a buddy system, and French forest agents always had to be accompanied by an Algerian forest agent, which I think is just really interesting. And I think the character of those people, those individuals who served as forest agents, it's fascinating. In many cases, they were kind of ostracized by their compatriots by their community because they were seen as working for the enemy. But on the other hand, they had insights and connections that the French forest agents definitely didn't have. And being a forest agent was a very dangerous job. There is a pretty high death rate among forest agents, especially in colonial context, but even in France, because, you know, they did things that were unpopular, like kick people out of forests or prevent people from gathering wood or staying in forests or setting fires in forests or, you know, really doing anything that they weren't supposed to be doing. And sometimes putting people in prison or exacting a fine. In the case of Algeria, there were all sorts of fines. There were usually fines and forced labor for indigenous groups and tribes, nomadic tribes that were seen to be using the forest in ways that were no longer legal, but, you know, that had been common before the French arrived. And then they were fined in ways they could never afford to pay. And they were consequently even more marginalized and in debt to the French government. So I think, I mean, you know, the binary is useful. The colonial colonized binary and the metropole rural binary, but there are also a lot of gray areas that I sometimes think those are the most interesting areas. And I don't know, I mean, there are a lot of examples, but I think I'll just give a few because they're, I could go on and on about this.
No, and that's one of the awesome things about your book is that there's so much here and you're comparing these three different case studies, but like, I found myself wanting to be like, oh, I want to know more about what's going on in each one of those situations. And you could write, like, I'm sure you could easily write, you know, three different books about these situations. Of course it would be a different project. But I also do like these comparisons that you're able to draw across these different cultures and geographies as well. And kind of on that note, looking at Anatolia and the Ottoman Empire, do you want to talk about how the French Forest Service or the French Forest agents came in and helped kind of establish an Ottoman school of forestry and help the Ottomans cultivate their own set of forestry policies?
Yeah, so So, just because this is one of the discoveries for me that really led me to the story. I actually started from an Ottoman perspective. I was originally planning to do an Ottoman history of nomads, so a little bit more like what you were just saying, more in depth about that particular history. But what I discovered just in my preliminary research was that the history of Ottoman scientific forestry was largely French. The two initial agents who jump-started forestry in the mid-19th century were French. They were French foresters who had trained at the French Forest School. One of them, actually both of them, were from the south of France originally. So they had that Mediterranean history. But they also trained, by training at the French Forestry School in northern France, they had this idea of what forests were supposed to look like and about this Mediterranean environmental decline that they thought was even more egregious in the Ottoman Empire, because they believed that the Ottoman government, through its corruption, through its decline, et cetera, this is when around this time is when the Ottoman Empire gets branded as the sick man of Europe. They thought it had squandered its lush forest resources. And so they saw themselves as sweeping in to help save it by establishing a modern forest regime there. And again, you know, I think they were trying to help, but they were largely misguided, and they were also largely unsuccessful because they didn't have the authority or the people power to implement the practices that they advocated for. But they did establish basically a textbook for Ottoman foresters, and they trained a generation of Ottoman foresters, so people who are actually Turkish, and they translated the French forestry textbook into Ottoman Turkish. And so by doing so, they really implemented these French and more broadly European perceptions and practices into the Ottoman context. And similar to the French case, the Ottoman government's interest in all of this was largely to have additional justification for and ability to settle nomads. And they did. They finally mostly succeeded in the mid to late 19th century. And those nomads who did not settle became increasingly marginalized. They were no longer these regional sort of strongholds of that might challenge central authority. And actually, one of the initial spark for this book dates back to when I studied abroad in Turkey as an undergrad, and I got to see some of the remaining nomadic groups. And they were not a particularly imposing bunch. They were, you know, kind of they very obviously marginalized, and also in many ways a dying breed. They're just not very many of them around anymore, and that's largely a result of these changes in policy over the course of the 19th century.
Yeah, and the second part of your book really gets into the marginalization of mobile pastoralism. And, you know, going back to Algeria as well, I thought it was really interesting how they seem to be the most active in their revolutionary stance, where some of them were possibly arsonists who were lighting fires, not just for pastor or to promote pastor land, but to actually rebel against the colonial rule. But in all of these places, there you demonstrate active and passive forms of resistance. Do you wanna talk about that, especially as we move into the mid to late 19th century?
Sure. Yeah, and I'll talk a little bit about sources too. So the advantage of doing a comparative history or a broad comparative study like this. Well, first of all, I think this is what I'm best at, and it's sort of what excites me to see patterns and connections that are across broad spaces like this. But the other advantage is, again, that it exposes these kinds of patterns that that you might not catch or even be aware of if you're focused on a particular context. The disadvantage, or one of the disadvantages, is that you lose a lot of that detail. And related to that, another disadvantage is sources. So I would love to have been able to dig more into sources, and particularly to do more to kind of elevate and amplify the voices of the pastoralists themselves. That's a challenge, not just because of the scope of my study and the detail and work that would require, but it's also a challenge because these are nomads. So they tended not to write stuff down. So trying to access their voices is really difficult, especially, you know, when your time frame is over 100 years ago. So I had to do a lot of kind of complicated detective work and writing around these perspectives to try and understand what was happening. It's less conclusive and less detailed than I would like it to be. But some important things appeared in my research. So for example, despite the French efforts to crack down on forest fires were more and more common in French colonial Algeria, particularly during this period of sort of extremely I'll just call it extreme colonization, where the local populations and nomads, not just nomads, but nomads and other local inhabitants, other indigenous Algerians, were very much marginalized and subjugated to French rule and French settlers. It's generally known as the settler colonial era. Forest fires were extremely common, and they were common in times and places where natural causes are not very likely. That's one clue that indigenous Algerians were using fire as a way to fight back. Certainly the French blamed them for fire during this period and during other periods. But I think that it's pretty clear that at least some of those fires were arson and were, an effort for indigenous inhabitants to fight back in the only way that they knew how. But again, it's really hard to access their voices and their perspectives because they tended not to write things down. And that's also true for the nomads or the Yuruk in Anatolia. And to some degree, the pastoralists in southern France as well.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I appreciate that acknowledgement of limitations as well. Because as I'm running into as a historian or a historian in training, and a lot of the discussion in my grad seminars are what sources are used, why did they use these sources, and things like that. So I appreciate that insight because I think it's. It really helps open up an understanding about how challenging doing good history actually is. Going back to the idea of settler colonialism that you evoked just a minute ago, though, one other point that really stuck out to me is the idea of property and property rights and kind of recreating or reconstructing landscape. Especially in the way of the French logic of people, these nomadic collectives don't actually have a stake in the game because they don't own the land, and so therefore they're not going to care about it, or they don't have any future investment in it. And so they decided that's where they needed to go and either close it off or make it private. And it seems like this is kind of a pattern throughout all of these three case studies. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's another piece of it that I especially look at in chapter 5, Against the Grain. But it's kind of the classic argument of the tragedy of the commons. But my work is arguing largely against that. that it's another perception and in many ways misconception by French policymakers and French foresters that and also other French imperial agents that indigenous inhabitants and pastoralists, mobile pastoralists in particular, aren't making efficient and sustainable and effective use of the land. And this is in the broader context of intensive and extensive privatization throughout Europe. So in a way, in France, it's certainly happening. And then in French colonial Algeria, and by extension, through the impact of French forest agents, it's being applied. This mentality of privatization is being applied more broadly in colonial and imperial and global contexts. But it's very much this classic idea that common land is not going to be used effectively. And so, for example, in Provence, you see the commons pretty much, which were very common before the 19th century. They were really an essential, a critical part of every community. You see them being eliminated over the course of the 19th century. And the commons were really important for pastoralists. They were a place where pastoralists could take sheep. So especially small-scale pastoralists, after the elimination of the commons, really had nowhere to take their sheep anymore. And that was a way of squeezing them out of the industry and paving the way for pastoralism to be taken over by large commercial agriculturalists who would just stable sheep. They wouldn't, they tended not to migrate with them.
Yeah, that's interesting. And to kind of get to the end of your book and into the conclusion and looking beyond the 19th century into the 20th century, you do observe that this is the time where in the 20th century, it moves from what was sustainable exploitation to actual just preservation of the forests. And to some of that actually was helped by also better transportation along with better communication to reach into these places that were harder to control in the mid 19th century. Is that, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so so going back to that original question, what happened to all the sheep? Where did they go? How did they go there? Why did they disappear? The state, over the course of the 19th century, the ability of the state to control people and environments expanded immensely. The state, in all three of these cases, the state by the end of the 19th century had a much greater reach. And that is through the expansion of communication and transportation networks. I mean, things like the railroad, which developed in all three of these cases, as well as things like the telegraph, which expedited and facilitated communication across large distances, as well as new military technologies that allowed modern states to control people, you know, physically through military presence. So all of these features allowed the state to control populations much better than it had been able to before. And they all helped the state to implement policies that effectively eliminated mobile pastoralism from all of these contexts. And along with that trend in modernization was a trend toward commercial agriculture, privatization, like I said, and industrialization. So if you looked at, for example, Provence in the late 19th century or the early 20th century, the landscape would just look so different than it had 100 years earlier. There were a lot more people, especially in the summer months. Prior to this industrialization, urbanization, and privatization, the coastal regions of Provence, as well as to a large degree the Eastern Mediterranean, slightly less the case in Algeria, They were mostly deserted. And that was partly because they could be a haven for malaria carrying mosquitoes. So people generally didn't settle there. And pastoralists could use those regions because they migrated. So they weren't there in the summertime. But I guess then I could add to what caused this change, the discovery of quinine as a way to combat malaria allowed people to live in these regions year round, and consequently greatly increased population around the Mediterranean coastal regions, and again squeezed out small scale mobile pastoralists.
Yeah, that's really interesting to think about even how medicine and the history of medicine plays into all of this. And you, I mean, your book demonstrates how interconnected and intertwined all of our histories are, even though we tend to bifurcate them through periodization or geography or nationality or race or even intellectual discourses. It's all interconnected, and it's so cool. And one other thing that I really, really enjoyed in this throughout your book, especially at the end, is that you really are able to capture the idea that the climate has always been changing and people have always been reacting or trying to predict how to navigate the changes, because you mentioned that there's always been these various forms of flooding or mudslides or fire or plagues of locusts or epidemics that have contoured our relationship to the natural world. And I wonder if can we draw lessons in the contemporary from this period and from these experiences that you're documenting here?
Well, I hope so. I certainly think so. To be a little less facetious, I think what the policymakers and French foresters were doing in the 19th century, many of us are doing now, again, with good intentions. We are trying to predict the future. We are making the call about environmental issues. And we need to do that. It's important. The climate is changing, and the way we're using the world is not sustainable. But what I'm trying to do with this book and this historical, to the extent that it's that this history, this story is an example, and I hope a useful one. I'm trying to show that, well, good intentions don't always breed good results, that we need to understand the broader context, that we need to be very careful about the conclusions that we draw based on what we're seeing, what we're experiencing, because they can have major ramifications. And in the case of this story of the French environmental policy in the 19th century Mediterranean, the intent was at the very least to save the environment. To use it sustainably, yes, but ultimately to preserve it. And the result was that the environment was used in a much less sustainable way. The way that mobile pastoralists had used it, their use, their exploitation of the Mediterranean environment was much more sustainable. I know sustainable it's a tricky, thorny word, but the way that mobile pastoralists traditionally use the environment was much more sustainable than the way that commercial agriculturalists, timber operators, industrialists, and urban populations used the environment in the late 19th century to the present. It's a story, and I think the lesson, it's a useful story, I think. And the lesson is that we need to think very carefully about the conclusions that we draw and the practices that we pursue, because just because we have good intentions or because we want to address environmental issues doesn't mean that we're actually going to do so successfully if we don't understand the full context.
Yeah, and to build off of that, the other lesson that I really took away from it is the idea of blame and how blame can be used as political rhetoric in terms of these colonial settlers coming in. I mean, do you want to talk about real quick just about this idea of blame and how they blamed pastoralists for these issues?
Yeah, I mean, and I guess going along with that, I had probably too much fun with my chapter titles.
I don't think so. They were awesome.
Thank you. I'm glad you appreciated them. I can tell you a little bit of a secret. So this is based on my dissertation, and my dissertation advisor, John McNeil, was reading these chapters, and I had, you know, this was when I was in grad school and I had a preliminary outline. And I had just put those chapter titles in there. They're all puns. I put them in there to give myself some entertainment when I was just working really hard and it was like a fun thing to do, but I fully planned to remove them. And I think in my not sufficiently slept brain, I forgot to remove them before I sent my outline to him. And his first comment was, "These chapter titles are great." So I decided to keep them. But the reason that I was going to remove them is because I think this is it's a tragic story in many ways, and it's certainly a serious story. And what I don't want to do is make it seem less important or significant or serious because I'm having fun with the titles. But at the same time, I do want it to be engaging and entertaining, which can be a challenge with historical scholarship or scholarship in general. And so I hope it serves that role. And then the other thing is, there are just so many sheep puns out there. So it's just, you know, there's just so much to choose from. And that really made sense for the content. So the sixth chapter is nature's scapegoats. And it's totally appropriate. So in this case, I'm not talking quite literally about goats, but more specifically about pastoralists. So about the shepherds of sheep and goats and how they were blamed for problems that they clearly had nothing to do with. Again, things like landslides, deforestation, the Mistral, I mean, even the extreme wind in Provence, as well as in Algeria, and just more generally environmental problems that were actually large, and fire is another important one, problems that were largely the result of the arrival of modern industrial society in things like commercial agriculture, the cork industry in Algeria, and the timber industry around the Mediterranean. So these are things that developed in the 19th century, and ironically, even as mobile pastoralists were being pushed out, they were being blamed more and more for the negative environmental impacts that were occurring in the regions they used to inhabit.
Yeah, and that's amazing to hear about the story about your chapters. happy accidents, yeah. I suppose. And since we learned a little bit about your past, and I know we've taken up a lot of your time, do you want to tell us a little bit about your future and what you have going on in terms of, you know, your projects looking forward?
Sure. Well, I like I mentioned earlier, I really enjoy these broad connective studies, as challenging as they are, because I think they highlight connections that are often overlooked and that are also really important. Well, at least equally important to the detail that emerges when we sort of hyper focus on a case study or a country. So for my next project, I'm currently working on a book project that's under contract with Routledge. And it's going to be a study of the environmental dimensions of imperialism and global in scope. So it's actually a lot more broad than this study is, but I'm really excited about it. I'm really excited because I think it's going to provide that it's going to expose patterns and connections that are often overlooked when we study the environment and imperialism in more specific contexts and more specific periods. I think being able to look globally for patterns, as well as important distinctions. So I'm not, you know, I want to emphasize when I'm doing comparative studies, I'm not just trying to seek out patterns, because I think the distinctions are really important and illuminating as well. I think it's going to tell us a lot. That more specific focused studies haven't. And even though the literature on environment and empire is certainly not lacking. But maybe because this is such a broad, ambitious project, there's really nothing like this out there, at least that tries to be sort of a synthetic text rather than an anthology or edited volume. So I'm really excited about that. It's pretty daunting, but the way I'm framing it is thematic. So I think that's going to help. So I'm looking first at human exploitation of the environment and how that connects to imperialism. And then in the second part, I will look kind of it'll be a little bit of the environment strikes back. So environmental impacts on human populations, and that'll be things like environmental change, environmental challenges and natural disasters, and their impact on imperialism and imperial contexts. And then in the third part, kind of building on those previous two sections, I'm going to be looking at the birth of conservationism and environmental ethics, modern environmental ethics. And I think that that's important to tie to imperialism because it reminds us of some of the sort of darker elements in what I consider to be a very, very important, even critical effort today in a time of climate change. But it also draws attention to ways in which the non-West has contributed to contemporary environmental ideals. And those stories often get left out, even of histories that claim to be global in scope or at least international. I think we're most familiar with a history of empire as defined by a history of Western empires or European empires. But I'm going to try to use my own expertise as well as that of my colleagues, and I'll need a lot of help to try and access non-Western empires and non-Western perspectives as well.
I love that idea of collaboration, and that sounds like such an ambitious, awesome book that I hope I hope when you get it published, you can come back on the Environmental Studies channel and discuss it again or have another discussion with us. But for now, to find these patterns and distinctions, I would encourage all of our listeners to go out and pick up a copy of No Man's Land, Pastoralism in French Environmental Policy in the 19th Century Mediterranean World. And thank you so much, Andrea. This has been such a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Matt. I really enjoyed chatting about the book and great questions. I really appreciate it.